This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast out of the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland called Out of Doors, which this week featured a right old ragbag of stuff. We had a fascinating, it's not a moth trap, it's like a moth refuge, where a really interesting village down on the shores of Loch Tay, and an albatross called Albert in Yorkshire.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
You know the kind of day when you wake up in the morning and you step outside and the sun is just clearing the horizon and it's warm and nothing aches and it's summertime. It's just lovely. That's this morning. If you haven't been outside already, it's a real treat and it's waiting right there for you. I'm Mark Stephen. With me in the car park this morning here at Beechgrove in Aberdeen, one Mr. Rory Crawford. Good morning to you.
Hello, Mark. We're both in short sleeves. It's something special, eh?
It's unusual. And that's got to be the world's most redundant fire. What a waste of time that was.
It's part of the magic of the show, though.
First off, tell us a bit about you. I mean, what's your background? What do you do?
So, Mark, I am a marine biologist by training. Although I spent a few years in the marine biology wilderness, aka the land, working in conservation for the RSPB, which I still do now, although I mainly work with folk in the southern hemisphere trying to stop albatross being caught in fisheries, and we'll chat a bit about albatrosses later. So that's kind of my day job, and then on the side of that I do a bit of work for CBeebies, so I film a show with my son called Teeny Tiny Creatures. So I'm acquainted to working with children and animals and thought, why not?
You fit right in, your son.
But live radio.
Live radio. It can't be any worse. And yet. What's that in your arm, the left one?
I have got a tattoo of a razorbill skeleton on my left arm, Mark.
Why a skeleton? I can understand the bird, but why bits of a bird?
Because, you know, I think the architecture of an animal's skeleton is remarkable, right? And there's this amazing bird by an artist called, by an artist called Katrina Van Grau called The Unfeathered Bird, where she takes a fresh look at creatures you might normally find in a natural history museum. And rather than them posed in these sort of static positions, unlike they'd be in the natural world, she poses them in fantastic and different ways. Now, right enough, the tattoo I've got is just a razorbill sat on a cliff. But I think that you can learn so much about these animals from the inside of their bodies and how they operate, so that's why I've got it. And I'll tell you my razorbill story later on, Mark. We'll be chatting about birds, won't we?
We will be chatting about birds. Well, interesting. You reminded me of something there. I think it was the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow had, maybe still has, the skeleton of one of the early Clydesdale horses, because the Clydesdale horse didn't just happen. It was designed. I mean, they were designed for specific purposes, and it's the clearest indication of why they were designed that way. You know, the cow hock, the legs coming at the back, so you'd have a single driving point of power, that kind of stuff. You see the skeleton, and it just makes sense. Just you understand the animal in a way that you can't possibly do when it's fleshed.
Absolutely, and I've sat and looked at a razorbill on a cliff. It looks like a little sort of Bond-esque seabird with its wee suit on.
Aye.
And then look inside, you can see the size of the breastplate for those big swimming muscles to attach to. It's a different story when you can see inside.
Yeah. This is not your first time in Out of Doors either, is it?
Well, regular listeners, I'm sure, will remember a highly forgettable interview that I had when you ambushed me at a meeting of the Clyde Marine Partnership in St Andrews in the Square.
He's good at that. Yeah.
In Glasgow. And I was a very young Marine Policy Officer for RSPB Scotland, a few weeks into the job. And he started asking me for my take on marine spatial planning, which, as you can imagine, was
deep and fulsome.
Oh, I mean, it was fulsome and people would have been riveted. I'm sure people still talk about it and call it the show today, right?
They talk of little else.
Oh, dear. I was worrying that somebody would find archive of that interview.
Listen, you were lucky. He normally grabs in minutes after they've just got the job and said, tell me all about such and such.
Oh, Ewan, if I could get a hold of you now.
Yeah, no, listen, still on the loose on the west coast somewhere on his boat and having a fabulous time by the sound of it. If you caught the programme last week, you'll have heard our trip along the River Tay from Killin to Dunkeld. Now, we spent time at Ben Lawer's National Nature Reserve and Ewan remarked on how much had changed since the last time he'd been there.
Agnes McCohen was listening to that programme and she got in touch to say it brought back memories of the very first outing of the Scotsman Mountaineering Club in November 1959 to Ben Lawer's.
Now, Agnes's late husband, Dr. Rennie McCohen, and I knew Rennie reasonably well because he was a regular on this programme years ago, was a journalist in the Scotsman, and he founded the club known today as the Ptarmigan Club of Edinburgh. And Agnes says there was no car park at Ben Lawer's back then, so we walked to the summit from the main road. That is a fair schlep. We were a motley crew of 10 with all sorts of put-together gear. I'm still a motley crew of put-together gear. Our wee bus had wooden seats. Wow. Best wishes and thanks for a great programme, Agnes McCohen. Well, thank you very much for that, Agnes, and thanks for getting in touch. If you missed that episode, you can find it on BBC Sounds. Just look for Out of Doors on the 10th of July. Now, when I mentioned the word eel, people react in funny ways. You know, some folk just don't like the thought of eels. There's something sort of slippery, slimy, snake-like about them. Other people find them utterly fat. I mean, what's your position on eels?
I love eels. All kinds of eels. Moray eels that you find in the tropics are European eels. I love them.
Yeah.
Fascinating creatures. But I'm a marine biologist. I've got a, you know...
You've got a want.
I've got full disclaimer.
Full disclaimer on that one. Jack Wooten of the Forth Rivers Trust is very definitely a fan of eels. He's been instrumental in setting up something called the Forgotten Fish Project. So I met him down in Crammond in Edinburgh and I wanted to get something cleared up right from the off. Is an eel a fish?
Yeah, it is. So people sort of don't get that traditional idea of a fish when you look at an eel, just because of the shape of it, that elongated, almost snake shape. I've spoke to fishermen in the past which have said, so it is a snake, isn't it? And it's just a common misconception, but it is a fish, yeah.
It is a rather remarkable fish, though. I mean, just talk me through what makes it so remarkable.
The story starts in the Sargasso Sea. The eggs hatch out very quickly and float within the plankton as little larvae. And these float on oceanic currents to the continental shelf of Europe. And when they reach this shelf, when they reach our coastline, they're sort of translucent, roughly eel-shaped little creature. And they then migrate into fresh water and turn something called an elva. Now, this is a pigmented form, and this is what we'd sort of recognise as the eel. It looks just like a very small eel. It then migrates into fresh water and spends its life as a yellow eel, which is the longest life stage of the eel. And this can be decades long, or even up to a century. And it lives and it grows and it builds resources until it reaches a resource point where it can change into a silver eel. And this is a creature which has a black back, a silver belly. Its fins have changed shape. Its eyes have grown huge. And what it's doing this for is to change into an animal which can migrate back across the ocean to the Sargasso Sea to spawn and complete the life cycle.
Where is the Sargasso Sea?
You'd be looking east from Cuba area. And it's called the Sargasso seed because of the sargassum weed, which grows and floats on top of the patch of sea there. And it is absolutely massive, this bit of water. And when we say they spawn in the Sargasso Sea, we're saying and generalising in a huge area that really doesn't pinpoint too much for us.
You can understand why fishermen thought they were snakes, though. I mean, aside from the shape, occasionally they will migrate across land, which is why I asked you if it was actually a fish, because there's not many fish can do that.
It can definitely be mistaken as something else other than a fish, because there is some quite obscure traits to it. And like you said, yeah, it can cross over land. It has the ability to survive out of water for quite a long time, actually. What they do when they're out of water for a prolonged time is they puff up what we would essentially say are their cheeks, which are actually their gill covers, and they puff them up, and then they absorb the oxygen through their blood vessels that are close to the surface of the mouth. So there's amazing ways in which they adapt to their environment, and it just shows that they are incredibly resilient species and can survive through a great deal of hardship.
Looking back at its heyday, how big a role did eels play in the life of, you know, rivers, streams, etc., you know, and what role have they got now?
This is a creature which supports trophic levels across the board. It comes in as a very small animal, as a very small prey item, and is an enormous source of protein for things such as migratory birds, which time their migration to hit the key time in which eels arrive and boost up their fats or their reserves for themselves. And then as it goes into freshwater on our coast, it is food for a number of different fish species, and it grows and develops into this yellow eel. It still provides food for other fish. It still provides food for mammals such as otters, which absolutely love eels. And as it then grows and develops into a larger eel, it becomes a predator, and it then is like a caretaker of the river. It eats the sick and the ill species. It cleans a lot of sort of the detritus that we would see in our rivers, and it just keeps the general health of not only the rivers but also the populations within them. It keeps everything nice and healthy. And in terms of us, you know, in terms of a species, the human race, the Doomsday Book brings to light how people used to depend on eels. Things like paying their rent. They used to pay their rent in eels. They used to build grand structures like cathedrals and churches and pay for these in eels, which is incredible.
Once upon a time, you know, if you've been able to scoop up every living thing in that river beside us at the moment, what sort of percentage of the biomass would eels have made up?
They say that roughly around half of the biomass of a river was the eel. And when you think of this as, you know, the living life within a river, that's quite an incredible amount, really. That's a significant amount. And this decline of upwards of 90%, that, you know, puts into stark reality of what we are actually missing in our rivers nowadays.
So what's caused that decline?
In the mid-80s, there was a huge drop. So this was the young eels coming back to Europe, and this was a drop of up to 99% in some areas of Europe, which is, you know, that's very much unheard of in such a small amount of time. But the really, really important thing here is that we do know what is hindering them returning back. And this is everything from pollution to overfishing and illegal fishing in the past, and illegal fishing is still very much an issue nowadays. There is disease, introduced diseases that came over in the 80s as well. And there are things like river barriers, such as weirs, dams, sluice gates, that I believe is one of the biggest impact on this species.
The project that you set up, the Forgotten Fish Project, basically looks at two things at the moment: monitoring and barrier easement. Now, define that for me. What does that actually mean?
The monitoring side of things is really us just getting an understanding of the eel in the fourth catchment. And we determine this on the abundance of eels within that area, just so that we can focus and get our resources into the key areas. But the barrier easement thing is really, this is something I absolutely love, and I think it's so interesting. And it's creating fish passes or the removal of river barriers. Things like weirs and dams and sluice gates. These all alter the flow patterns of a river so that it doesn't flow normally. And these structures are everywhere, and the majority of them are not being used. And there's approximately 1.2 million river barriers man-made river barriers across Europe.
Can I ask you to take your ecologist's woolly tammy off, you know, and answer this question on a personal level? Why are you so fascinated by eels?
If you see an eel out of water, it's not that elegant and it's flapping around everywhere and it is incredibly slimy. It doesn't look that attractive at all. But when they're in water, it's something else. There's something quite majestic about this animal, and the way that it moves through water is something to behold. It's quite incredible.
It's like water in water.
Yeah, that's a perfect analogy, to be honest. It just moves exactly how it should to get the least resistance to where it's going. And they are truly amazing to see.
Jack Wooten from the Forth Rivers Trust there.
I mean, lots of folk don't like eels, right? Mm-hmm. They are unusual creatures.
They are unusual. I was trying to think if I could tell this story, and I'm going to do it by not giving the sort of geographical location away. I was visiting friends a few years ago, quite close to where there is a marine sort of visitor centre. And this pickup truck came hurtling round the corner towards the quay, literally in two wheels, with four guys fighting something in the back of this pickup truck. And I've always got recording equipment with me. And without just sheer reflex, grabbed the gear, started running towards this pickup truck. And as I got closer and they could see the microphone, they went, no, please don't record this. We'll tell you about it in a minute. I said, okay, fair enough. And they had one of these big conger eels, and it was too big for the tank now, and they were going to release it into the river, which was just at the sea. It was just, I mean, it was as thick as a man's thigh, and it was just muscle, pure and simple. I mean, it took four guys, they had this thing in a blanket and they had those special gloves on, you know, almost like tackety gloves, you know, so they could actually get a grip on this thing. What a fight they had to get this thing out of the thing and in the water, and it was off. Fascinating animals.
Amazing. And this is perhaps an apocryphal tale, but you've reminded me of my pal Mark, who's an angler. So take this with the biggest pinch of salt necessary.
Anglers always tell the truth, remember?
Of course. But he said he'd caught a friend of his, because it's always a friend, isn't it? Or them.
Friend of a friend.
He'd caught, I think it was a conger eel, and they reckon they'd dispatched it on the boat, put it in the cool box to get it home, plans to eat it, had stuck it in the fridge, and apparently later that evening had gone, opened the fridge door, and the eel leapt out and grabbed him in the nose. I mean,
I might not believe the bit that grabbed in the nose, but years ago I was doing a programme in Bimbecula with a Frenchman called Jean Didier Hache. And as we arrived, because he had this fantastic cottage, you know, just basically on the sea, and he says, oh, I've made some lunch, I've made this bouillabaisse. And I said, fantastic. And he says, and part of it was this eel that he'd caught. And as he'd caught it 2 days previously, he'd cooked the bouillabaisse, that was fine. And as he went to get the soup out of the fridge, the other half of the eel knocked the fridge door open. Before he turned out, it wasn't, you know, certainly didn't attack him or anything like that. But the vitality of these things is extraordinary.
Hard as nails, and no wonder that they're able to migrate all the way to the Sargasso Sea. So you might not like eels, but you have to respect them.
Have to respect them, yeah, certainly keep an eye on them. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen, he's Rory Crawford. Coming up in the programme, how Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park is coping with visitors this summer, and it's a bit of a chaff. And we've butterflies and moths galore.
Join me, Ricky Ross, for a brand new podcast where I'm in conversation with some of our most admired songwriters and musicians. You'll hear from influential names like Cliff Richard.
I've been so fortunate with the songs I've been given. How could I possibly turn down Devil Woman?
Elvis Costello.
Watching The Detectives, on the other hand, was the first time that I really sensed I was making a record.
And Eddie Reader.
That magic carpet, perfect, has just got me everywhere, you know, in the world.
Subscribe for new episodes every week. Just search for Ricky Ross Meets on BBC Sounds.
I saw something the other day and it was Annie Lennox singing with Eddie Reader as backing. Fascinating. At the start of the lockdown, way back in March, many people really began to appreciate green spaces. Some for the first time, others just because it was part and parcel of their daily routine. Now, I am lucky because I live in the countryside. Rory, you're not. I mean, it's not that you're not lucky, but you are an urban dweller. You don't live in the countryside. How was that time for you?
Yeah, well, certainly it felt challenging. You know, somebody who lives in an urban-ish environment but loves green space, that was difficult. But I'm lucky. I've got my own garden. Many folk in cities do not.
I've walked less than half a mile from my house in a suburb of Glasgow to a place that in the past 18 months I've been to hundreds of times. We're lucky to have this local nature reserve. It's got a loch, a small woodland, some big old trees that have hosted lots of songbirds. I'm looking at a roe deer right now grazing away. Plenty of that too. Yes, both rain and traffic. We are in the burbs, remember. But some of the songbirds I've heard have included migrating warblers, nesting owls, nesting nuthatches, plenty of blackbirds, wrens, robins, all the usual favourites. And there's some nice open areas of wildflowers that are just alive with bumblebees at this time of year as well. So far, so normal, perhaps you're thinking. A curiously mundane choice for your opening piece on Out of Doors, Rory. And you'll surely have heard much more impressive places profiled on this programme. And obviously, I love those places. I'm a marine biologist. I love the coast, the life beneath the waves, the miniature world of rock pools, the flowering macher, the towering cliffs and the incredible seabird colonies that bridge the gap between the terrestrial and the marine. But for obvious reasons, like most folk, this past 18 months I've spent a lot of time much closer to home with my family. And while I did pine for the world beyond my doorstep and was lucky to have a holiday in Lewis at the start of June, the pandemic has obviously made me appreciate how fortunate we are to have this local green space. And of course, all the wonderful creatures we share it with. Just listen to that black cap going for it. What a chatter. Once we were allowed to leave our homes for exercise, we came here every day, tracking every inch of the seasons as they moved. We watched the leaves poke out from the buds, heard the first chiff-chaffs and willow warblers, saw mallards, coots, moorhens and swans all raise their young in a diet of whatever folk brought them. Keep off the bread, folks. Many people did the same, obviously. Lots of people that never paid nature much heed were suddenly switched on to birdsong and observation of the passing of the seasons. If not that, then just the simple escape, headspace and literal space of getting somewhere green became so important. It probably won't be a surprise for listeners to hear that access to places like this is not equally shared, and I'm not talking about central London. According to Office for National Statistics analysis, the average distance to the nearest public park, if you don't include playing fields in Scottish towns and cities, is the greatest among England, Wales and Scotland at roughly a mile. And those public parks, once you get there, are smaller on average. 13% of households in Scotland have no access to a private or shared garden. So this perhaps feels surprising for a country that can boast the Cairngorms and the Caledonian pine woods, the solitude of a Hebridean beach, the seemingly endless open expanse of the Flow Country. But of course, this isn't anything new. It's about how our cities are planned and built and how sufficiently, or rather insufficiently, green space has been created and protected for the benefit of nature and people. When the pandemic shrank everyone's world to the immediate environment, these disparities in the available green space were simply laid bare. Why does it matter? Green space isn't just important for wildlife, though for people like me, that's a big enough reason to have the space. It's vital as a recreation space, to improve air quality, to support the fight against climate change, or just as a mental escape, a breathing space to dial down the anxiety and help get those endorphins pumping through your veins. So, where am I going with this? I'm obviously incredibly passionate about protecting the incredible places we already have here in Scotland and restoring some of the lost wonders, whether that's the true expanse of the Pinewoods or Peatlands or seagrass meadows and merle beds. But let's not forget about protecting and restoring those wee places in our towns and cities. Let's shrink the distance that Scottish citizens have to walk to their nearest park, and let's make it a place for everyone to enjoy nature. Only good things can come of it.
Only good things can come of it as long as you don't naff off that swan in the way that you obviously did. That sounded annoyed.
I'd like to say that I was sat and the swan approached me just to tell me it was annoyed. I mean, why they call them mute swans, I don't know, because they always sound a bit livid.
Yeah, they just there's a definite element of threat there. Sticking with Glasgow and green spaces, we'd heard nothing about this. I find this fascinating. There's a campaign, apparently, to make Glasgow the first national park city in Scotland. Now, to tell us all about national park cities and why Glasgow should be one is Toby Clark, who's a Glasgow National Park City Group volunteer. That's a hell of a badge to carry, Toby. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Good morning from, beautiful sunny Glasgow.
Excellent. I'm delighted to hear it. We've had a complaint from the Uists apparently saying it's rubbish across there, which I'm sorry to hear, but glad to hear it's sunny in Glasgow. Explain this to me. What is a national park city? What's the point of it?
So, well, the concept is simple. We know and we're familiar with traditional rural national parks, and the idea is to take those benefits of national parks and apply them to a city basis. It's part of it's quite a new idea, and it's part of a growing global movement for greener, healthier, wilder cities. And I think the concept is to take something that's familiar that everyone can get behind and create and harness that pride around our green spaces.
That sounds great, Toby. I mean, what I'm wondering, you said it's a global movement there. Are there examples already that exist that show us the sort of potential power of this National Park City movement?
Yeah, so in 2019, London became the first National Park City, and as part of that, there was a creation of National Park City Foundation that really creates a blueprint to support cities from across the globe realise their potential. And we've got nearly 40 cities from Albania, Argentina and Australia to Canada, Kenya and Korea, I think, that are all on this journey, this pathway to realise what a national park city concept could deliver for their places. And yeah, it's exciting because each one's different. The same as our 15 UK national park cities. Each one is unique and different. You know, the Norfolk Broads is incredibly different from the Cairngorms, and they respond to the different needs of where they're at. And I think that's at the heart of each city concept too. So yeah, I was interesting to hear what you were talking about earlier with regards to people accessing nature. And I think from a Glasgow perspective, you know, we recognise that there is huge health inequalities. And I think what also research is showing is that it's the people with health problems that are the least likely to visit and benefit from nature. So there's a real sort of potential opportunity for us to create nature-based solutions in Glasgow through perhaps this umbrella of a national park city.
And yeah, that sounds remarkable, really, to have such a diverse array of places involved. And you've mentioned some of the potential benefits for Glasgow itself. How do you see that working, Toby? So you can get the status as a national park city, and there's, you know, fair to say there's an amount of controversy perhaps about national parks here in the UK and the level of protection they afford to those places or the level of access it provides to people. How do you see facilitating people to get out and using whatever green space is created in somewhere like Glasgow?
I think it's important to recognise that this isn't about necessarily creating new projects or doing things that cuts across the fantastic good work that's going on across cities. What it aims to do is it aims to familiarise the concept and the pride of our green spaces and empower communities, unlock the potential of people getting actively involved in our cities and caring for them. You know, our cities have a significant impact on the planet. You know, we're all aware of that, but they also have a significant capacity for positive change as well. You know, if we can get things right, campaigns and initiatives like the Glasgow City Council Active Travel, the stalled spaces, these are brilliant examples. But we know we live in a time of nature and climate crisis, and we need to do more. And the concept of a national park city aims to bring all these strategies together, aims to bring all the community groups together, and create a familiar umbrella of a national park city so that people can access it, take pride of it, and understand it, and effectively engage in it.
You've got an event organised for next week.
Yes, so yeah, it's a reimagine event. It's as I say, it's a big, it's a new idea. At the heart of it, we need to get ensure that the people of Glasgow are interested and are behind it. So we're setting up these talks to engage with as many different people as possible. And there's a talk next Wednesday. It's online. Five reasons Glasgow should be a national park city, and we've got micro talks from our partners and our supporters. We've got videos. We've got examples of what's happening, the positive stuff that we're aiming to amplify. And really, we just want to ask the question as to how we can unleash the potential for a greener, healthier and wilder Glasgow.
Toby, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I find that a fascinating idea. Very kind of you.
Good stuff. Thanks, guys, for having me.
No problem at all. Toby Clark there. And if you would like to find out more about that event and the Glasgow National Park City Group, there is a link to their website from ours. It is an intriguing idea. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. With me this morning, coming to you live from the BBC car park in Aberdeen, Mr. Rory Crawford.
Coming up, we want you to get counting. And I will tell you now, it's not money. And Mark is blown away by an odd fact.
One person in the UK who makes spheres like this. His name is Charles, and he made the spheres on the original Daleks.
You're joking, did
he? He did.
Wow.
So
okay.
It's quite an unusual process.
I'm not impressed by much, but that impressed me.
You genuinely...
Wow! The Daleks? Really? The Daleks?
Picking up pieces of your mind after that one.
Yeah.
All will be revealed shortly. And remember, you can get in touch with us. Let us know what you're up to. Ian from Argyll has done that already. He says he's fascinated by eels. When I was younger, I lived beside the River Spey and often saw eels. My brother and I used to love watching them. Big fan of the show and have been listening for 30 years.
Good grief. Man and boy, as the saying goes. This text came in since years ago. We watched a cormorant eating an eel in the middle of the pond in Kelvingrove Park in Glasgow. The eel was putting up a fight. Well, it would, wouldn't it? But the cormorant was a match for it. I've never seen it with a cormorant. I saw it with a heron once.
Oofed.
And literally, I mean, the eel kind of wrapped itself around about the heron's neck. I mean, I know we're going on about eels a lot, but they are remarkable animals.
I mean, if I was that heron, I would have certain thoughts.
Just spit it out.
Exactly.
Spit it out and walk away, a sadder and wiser bird. Anyway, we've had a fabulous spell of weather recently. I mean, it's real summer weather. It's holiday weather. And quite understandably, folk want to get out and about and enjoy it, which is great, as long as you've got the resources to actually cope with it. Last year, a lot of our tourist hotspots really struggled to cope with the influx of visitors. I mean, kind of a double whammy, not just the fact that people couldn't travel abroad, but there was all that kind of built-up tension of lockdown. So when it was released, everybody went slightly nuts, you know, and they were delighted to get out. Is it going to be any different this year? Recently, I went to Balloch to speak to Kenny Auld, head of visitor services for the Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park.
I think at the start of the season, we saw a big increase. Everybody was out enjoying the park, enjoying Scotland's landscape. So then through the week, numbers were down because international tourism wasn't here to animate the spaces. And we saw tourism businesses were struggling with that boom and bust of weekends and midweek. But then now that school holidays are there and summer's really kicking in, numbers are really up there, as high as they were last season. But we've got more people on the ground and better infrastructure around to help them enjoy the landscapes.
What have you done in terms of actually boosting boots on the ground?
Last summer was very challenging. We were trying to work in exceptionally difficult circumstances with our hands tied behind our back financially, and also our staff are obviously people too, and across, doesn't matter if they work for the National Park or Forestry and Land or local authorities or Police Scotland, they have their lives, they have their family and they have their thoughts on health. So we had to work with them to try and get as many people out to help people enjoy the outdoors last summer. And then through the winter, a lot of work to really talk about the benefits of having people out on the ground, the benefits that positive interactions can change on behaviours. And knowing that we couldn't get the infrastructure in yet, it takes a while to put good quality infrastructure in and to justify the investment. So we could justify the investment in staff, and we saw that for the Scottish Government and other pots of money and other organisations putting their hands in their pockets to get people out there with good communication skills, talking and giving simple advice on where to go, how to behave and how to enjoy the best landscapes.
To a certain extent, Kenny, you're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, though, aren't you? Because you really want people to come out and enjoy Scotland, to enjoy the outdoors, but if you've got folk cutting down trees, building fires in the wrong place, causing a fire risk, littering, emptying chemical toilets, all of the above, the only option really is to have somebody there to say, actually, can I just get you to think about that a second?
Having people out in the outdoors is fantastic, full stop. And the more people you have out, actually, that can affect behaviour change for a very small minority of those who either don't know how to behave or are in a position where they don't want to behave in a certain way. So the more people you have behaving responsibly, that can also have a behaviour impact. So behaviour change is such a wide spectrum. Investment in infrastructure, quality infrastructure can change behaviours, we know that. And then also on the far end of the spectrum, enforcement powers when required that can have a behaviour change impact. But yeah, we want more people out in the outdoors. It's no a caveat of, oh, but they behave badly. We want more people out enjoying the outdoors, getting healthy and valuing their landscape. And once people value something, then they treat it better.
Talking about facilities, last year when I spoke to your chief executive, Gordon, it was about September time, and yeah. I think that, you know, the sudden, it was an onslaught.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden, some of the restrictions had been lifted and the place was mobbed. Parking was a real issue. Toilets were a real issue. You know, disposal of chemical waste was a real, you know, as in toilet waste, not chemical, like chemical waste. You know, all those things were real issues. Have those been addressed this year?
Yeah, huge strides have been made. I mean, and it's all partnership working. It's partners who, you know, have not had the time or the space to work together as well as we can. And that's whether it's Transport Scotland, local police and local authorities and the National Park and Forestry and Land Scotland. All these different groups and communities, of course, very importantly. So areas like the Cobbler is a great example. You know, iconic hill, huge volumes of people going there. No public transport really there, although we do want to address that with our partners and there's long-term aspirations. But that's a big ask. We have a culture based on, you know, cars dominating, particularly our rural areas and particularly around upland access. So you get car parks there full, no car sharing, so more cars than ever. No toilets, because a lot of cafes closed and cafes sell the coffee, but they're not offering the toilets, you know, an escalation there. So we've managed to put in lots of infrastructure, lots more toilets at key locations and lots more staff on the ground, clear messaging. Also clear messaging around planning ahead and having a backup plan. And although it's, you know, not everybody who follows that, but a number of people do, and it helps us manage points there. In terms of the car parks, we've had slight extensions on some key car parks just because it's the only option we really had at places like Ben Ann we're working in and the Trossachs. But we do want to have something better, particularly with the climate emergency we're all well aware of. You know, we know that car dominance in rural Scotland, particularly around visitor hotspots, doesn't help anyone. Nobody enjoys the congestion there. And we really want to invest in a coherent transport system where people see sustainable travel as part of their enjoyment of the landscape, part of their journey. In terms of visitor centres, we've had pop-ups and again, rangers and volunteers and local authority staff giving key information and helping people.
Do you get any kickback from the locals? And by that I mean, you know, if you say, look, tell you what, we actually need more car parking here. Yeah. Do locals ever say, no, we don't want more car park. We've had enough of the number of people that are coming already.
No, I mean, I think...
Seriously?
Well, you've got a mix. Communities are a mix of individuals. You'll have a lot of people who see the merit of car parks and want car park expansions. And you'll have, on the other side of the spectrum, no further car parks. It's a mix of what works in a location. We definitely want to have a better coherent system where public transport is invested in and it's a viable option. At the moment, we have free or very, very cheap parking. We're all used to it. At all our key sites, to cope with the volume of people who want to enjoy these areas, we're talking huge car parks. We asked on East Loch Lomond, we asked the police, you know, hypothetically, car park would you need to cope with the amount of people who currently want to come? And they just said you couldn't build it big enough. It wouldn't even touch the sides. And so it's just not an option for us. And communities are part of that as well. Communities don't really here have a transport system that, I think you'll find that across the board, that will be an agreement across, that really works for them. You know, car is the dominant mode here because it's really the only the show in time. There's a framework of transport which can work, and it does provide essential travel for residents. But for the millions of people in these areas, if we can work together to provide a transport system that provides for the visitors and provides them a viable kind of network and journeys, linking train to bus and bikes and to walking, then that will benefit residents as well. So in the shorter term, smaller car park extensions, but in longer term, more car sharing, better public transport provision and a better experience for anybody wanting to take public transport when it exists.
As we're standing here speaking, yep. You know, at point of recording, as the saying goes, and it might be completely different tomorrow, governments seem to be talking about the fact that, you know, yes, we're going to have to learn to live with COVID and restrictions will be lifted and you won't have to do this. And, you know, we want life to go back to normal. Is that the expectation of the national park? I mean, do you think the circumstance is going to be completely different in a year or 2 years or 3 years? But how far ahead are you planning and on what basis?
We are certainly looking at taking any of the positive behaviours, whether as an organisation or, you know, members of communities that we live and work in, and seeing how that can, some of the habits, the new habits we have, we can take forward. So I think the partnership working that we've done, it's better than it was in the old normal across the work. Some of our work-life balance for our staff and some of their kind of the work and dare say for our communities as well is better than the old normal. So it's, and we all know our, you know, the nature emergency, the climate emergency, we need to do better. And this is maybe, hopefully, giving us an opportunity for everybody to take stock and think what really matters. And what has come clear is that people really value these landscapes. They really want to come here.
Kenny Auld, Head of Visitor Services for Loch Lomond and Trossachs National Park then. I mean, the fact is, folk are, I think, going to continue to holiday in this country. And if they're going to do that, they have to have the facilities. You know, you can't expect people to go somewhere and say, well, sorry, there's no toilets. It's fine saying, well, hang on, we've got a climate emergency, which we do. You know, therefore, we shouldn't be encouraging people to use cars. Therefore, we shouldn't be increasing the size of car parks. But unless there is a public transport option already in place, where's your argument?
Absolutely. And it needs to be straightforward for folk, right? You know, like 42 buses to get somewhere, that's challenging. Yeah. So we need to string it together properly.
With a four-year-old.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen.
Indeed. It's just not in the cards, yeah. Right? So there are practical questions there that, you know, we've got to try and address, yeah, as a nation to get folk into these spaces in a sustainable way, right?
Yeah.
We've had a text, another text, about eels.
Okay.
Which is really setting everyone off this morning. From Sunny St Andrews. As a child, my grandfather told me that the Loch Ness Monster was a huge eel that thrived on porridge and nobody would bully it because it was healthy and strong and smart. And obviously that story was to get me to eat porridge for breakfast before school, which I hated. I mean, what was wrong with a Caramac and a Thruppence mixture from the shop on the way to school? Loving the show as ever. Catherine Douglas. And of course, other...
A Caramac,
yeah.
Wow, that takes me back.
You can still get a Caramac. I'm sure other sort of caramel-flavoured chocolate bars exist.
No, there is only one true caramel confectionery. I'm sorry, I won't hear a word against it.
Brilliant.
Yesterday I was up, you know, last night I was up in our top field. Beautiful evening, really lovely sunset too. It's just one of those sort of golden evenings. I couldn't believe it. There was four pink-footed geese flew over. Now, I haven't seen any geese at all, for must be knocking on 2 months now. I thought they'd all gone. And yet this four, that they must be resident throughout the summer, just crossed the field, quite low down. It was unusual. I mean, birds, we had the piece from you earlier, they've become really central to a lot of our lives.
Absolutely. And I speak as somebody who's kind of a convert to birds, actually. Uh-huh. And I know I work for the RSPB, so this is probably not something
it's a,
I should say.
It's a good career move.
But I've got to be honest, like when I was studying in university, doing marine biology, I thought birds. Yeah. bit boring, had a vision about what a bird watcher was. You'd probably be in a gilet. You'd probably have some...
Lots of pockets.
Trousers with pockets. Pockets everywhere. I don't know what for, but lots of pockets anyway. And I just had a real thing about, I'm not going to do birds. And then I actually, through doing my undergrad research in Gambia, West Africa, got chatting to my supervisor, David Houston, at Glasgow Uni, and he said... Birds are great. You should do your project on birds if you're going to go to West Africa. There's a huge array of species there. You've got to do it. It opened my eyes to it. And when I came back home, it was a total switch for me. And actually, for so many people, as you say, Mark, it is the immediacy, the ability to connect with something which is beautiful, which sings, which brings colour and texture to our lives. So, yeah, I have a special place in my heart for birds. And that's as a convert. I've got the zeal of a convert, Mark.
Well, one of the things I like about birds is that, you know, they sit still long enough and they come to you. And that was a truth that was acknowledged by Charlie Corbett, who was brought up on a farm in Hampshire. He's also got connections to Mull as well. As a young man, Charlie left the countryside and for a long while lived life in the fast lane. But it was only later, after some personal problems, that he began to discover a passion for birds, which he found very therapeutic.
I left all, not just birds, anything rural behind me and just charged off into the world studying history and then going on to be, I don't know quite how I ended up a financial journalist, but I did, then travelling the world, living in other cities, and I neglected it. You know, nature for me just became, like for a lot of us now, this old fading wallpaper in the background. And it was only when I got back, I'd been living in Australia working as a journalist for about 3 years, and I got back to the farm where I grew up. And I remember walking down a lane on a beautiful May evening and, you know, I thought I had no idea what was singing and what the trees were. You know, I barely knew the difference between a sparrow and a starling. And I thought, oh, this is no good. I need to do something about this.
In your book, you've chosen 12 birds to focus in on and used your encounters with them and related them to periods of personal difficulties in your life. Let's just start with a skylark, or the laverock as they're known here in Scotland. And I'm going to quote here from your book, "There is no better word to describe the feeling you have when you hear and see a skylark than exaltation," the collective noun for skylarks. I mean, it, without a doubt, it lifts your spirits. They came back into your life just at the point when your mum had a diagnosis of cancer. Talk me through that, because it goes without saying, it must have been an incredibly difficult time.
Mum had, was the sort of person who never complained. You know, she'd been having headaches and things like that, but eventually she had what we called a funny turn. Like with a lot of cancer diagnoses, the news just gets worse and worse, doesn't it? So she had a tumour in her head, but we all thought, oh, it's benign, it'll be fine, they can do wonders these days. And then it turned out it wasn't. And then the news was terminal cancer and not very long to live. And I remember that day going back. I'd been doing a lot of walking, and I'd also, you know, it was a time when I'd been trying to reconnect with nature, but in a kind of box-ticking way. You know, no one prepares you for bad news. There's no training for it. You just go numb, really. And so I just went for a walk in the rain on an August day up on the Pusey Vale, on the hill there, and was sort of sitting around in the rain getting wet. Then I heard a skylark sing, and skylarks shouldn't really be singing in August. No birds really sing in August because it's the molt, but it was, and it sang. It just sort of tied me down in a way. It didn't cure cancer, it didn't solve my problems, but what it did do was suddenly give my life a little bit of perspective, hearing that rolling, cascading song and watching this bird hovering just, you know, 30 or 40 feet above my head. What it did do was give me some mental ballast and more perspective on my life. And then it was from then on, it was a journey of kind of reconnection. We've become dislocated from our natural environment, and I don't think that's done us any good. I don't think it's done nature any good, because you can't love or care for what you don't know about. And if you don't know about the sparrows, you won't know they're all disappearing, or you won't build a relationship. And what, you know, I wanted to relate these birds to everyday life for people, because too often you tell someone you like birds or you listen to the birds, they look at you like you're a train spotter, you know. It's become, or a sort of obsessive hobbyist. And it's not that. It should be innate. Our ancestors knew this stuff. They move with the rhythms of the seasons. And they understood that life's a cycle.
Your next bird is the robin. I mean, everybody knows the robin, the national bird of Britain. But you were visiting your mum and you had a, a really special encounter with a robin that kind of helped you big time.
She died 6 months after the diagnosis, but those 6 months were us in Southampton General Hospital in the high dependency unit. You know, we barely left her side. There was my brother and sister and my father and me. We'd spend days in this hospital, and I used to go out into this rather drab car park and smoke furiously. I'd been trying to give up, but, you know, it wasn't working. One day, you just see a robin watching you. That's what robins do. They just pop up. Every day, I would go out and look out for that robin. And then, of course, if you're looking at a robin, you'll see other the kind of garden birds, you know, the blue tits and the great tits and obviously blackbirds and goldfinches. And suddenly there's this little world in another world opening up for you. And what it really taught me was what we never do. I think even when people are interested in nature, we rush out and look for it. And I think sometimes it pays to sit still somewhere, anywhere, even in a hospital car park in the middle of Southampton, because nature will find you if you just wait. It was the best advice I was ever given once years ago. Just sit under a tree and watch for as long as you can, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, and you'll find that nature comes to you. And that's what that taught me. And it sort of stills the beating mind, I suppose. It's an inbuilt coping mechanism that we have that we ignore at our peril, I would think.
How do you think that mechanism actually works? You sit still, fine. You know, the wildlife has probably been all around you all along, but you're not really seeing it. Is it the process of coming out of yourself, heading outward? Explain it to me.
Partly, it's wonderful that you don't know how it works. You know, nature does stuff to you that you don't realise it's doing it to you. You know, the coming of spring is something that's felt deep within us. It's part of the fabric of our being, spring. For me as well, it's the ultimate distraction. You know, you put your life into perspective. If, you know, nature just carries on, okay, it's a rhythm, it's a cycle, death and change happen, and it happens in nature, and we are of nature, not merely in it. We see ourselves as in nature. We've always, certainly since the Industrial Revolution, wanted to conquer nature rather than move with the rhythms of nature. And I always think, you know, we see stuff, but we don't watch, you know, and we hear, but we don't listen. And just watching nature is the ultimate distraction. Now, any example, yesterday I discovered a tree creeper nesting in the side of my shed in Wiltshire. That brought me unbelievable joy, and I can now watch that tree creeper going in and out all day. And there were two collared doves nesting in a yew tree, the blackbirds, of course, in the hedge. And suddenly my garden is alive with all this excitement. And if I hadn't tuned in, I'd never have seen that. And I'd never have got the joy. And it puts your life into perspective. You know, no longer the lead role in your own private melodrama, but a sort of just a bit part in nature's great epic. And I keep using that line over and again, but it, for me, it sums it up.
Charlie Corbett there. And Charlie has written a book about his experiences called 12 Birds to Save Your Life, which is the subject of the latest edition of our Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now on BBC Sounds. Is there a particular bird that you associate with?
So I've obviously got my razor bill tattoo. You mentioned at the top of the show, Mark.
You were going to tell the rest of that story.
Yeah, so why not? Why not now?
Go. If not now, then when?
Exactly.
As the current phrase seems to be.
So I had a beautiful experience in Battersea. I was out in down the Western Isles for some field work, and I was waiting for a colleague to arrive. We were staying in Barra for a night before we went off to an uninhabited island to go and look for rats, believe it or not. Okay. And I was taking a wee walk down to Battersea, and anyone who's been to Battersea knows there's a farm dog that will come and greet you as you arrive there and just follow you about if you give it a clap. So followed me about, went down to the beach. It was a beautiful sunny day. I was sat in one of those beaches, sort of those two horseshoe beaches on Battersea, and I could see the shoal of sand eels that had come into the shallows, and they were being herded by two razorbills who were just jetting about underwater, pinging about. Just a beautiful scene, stunning day, turquoise water, and this sort of wildlife documentary scene playing out in front of me. And that's the connection I made with that bird, thinking, you're remarkable, chasing these tiny little fish and catching them as you're going, popping up occasionally with beakfuls of them. Yeah. Just amazing to see.
It's that interface between, you know, air, land and sea. is extraordinary with these animals.
Absolutely. To think they're capable of these huge flights, you know, they've recorded razorbills during the breeding season, covering over 300 miles on round trips from Fair Isle down to the Aberdeenshire coast. Remarkable to think. And then for them to be so capable in the water, chasing things, catching tiny fish, it's truly remarkable.
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good.
So we have had a lovely email coming out of doors at bbc.co.uk about the podcast with Charlie Corbett there. It's from New Zealand, of all places. So, kia ora. Love listening to the podcast about the wonder and joy of birds. I'm listening to your podcast from Aotearoa, New Zealand. Birds are very much a motif in my life also. At present, I'm enjoying one of our native birds, the tui, who visits a tree outside our house every morning around 11. It's midwinter at present here, and they're preparing their territory ready for spring. The handsome, bossy birds with a tuneful, warbling song, complete with glottal stops.
The writer goes on and says, perhaps my favourite bird, however, is a skylark, so I did enjoy hearing the song of one on your podcast and then hearing your guest, Charlie Corbett, describing how the song brought him solace. Hearing him talk about Mull too brought back many happy memories of when, as young tourists on a working holiday in 1977, my husband and I worked in a hotel in Tobermory. Thank you for the sounds and stories of Scotland that your podcasts bring. Araha Nui. And that's from Kay Mackenzie Cook. Thank you very much, Kay, for actually getting in contact with us.
And folks, great to hear from you if you've got particular birds that you've connected with. Any stories about our feathered friends that have really touched you in a beautiful way, a funny way, a ridiculous way. Mark, have you got any birds that you've connected with?
I was thinking about this earlier. I think probably the curlew is the one that actually, because I mean, of a summer's evening, just hearing this thing, you know, because the hills up behind us, it just kind of follows the line of the land, you know, 20, 30 feet up. And the song seems to do exactly the same thing. It follows, it descends, it trills. What's his face? Robert McFarlane talks about it trailing bubbles of sound. It's a lovely image, and it's perfect for curlew.
Absolutely.
It's perfect.
Beautiful.
The Big Butterfly Count is Butterfly Conservation's annual three-week citizen science event. It kicked off yesterday, so there's still time to take part. Joining us now to tell us how to do that and why it's important is Anthony McCluskey, Project Officer with Butterfly Conservation in Scotland. Good morning, Anthony.
Good morning.
How does the count work?
Yeah, so it's a count which happens every year at the same time every year, and it's really easy to get involved. People can get involved this year by going outside for 15 minutes on a sunny day and just counting the butterflies they see, or even the butterflies they don't see, because even finding out that there are no butterflies is really useful as well. And they can get involved by entering their details through the app, which if they just search the app store for Big Butterfly Count, they can find that, or visiting bigbutterflycount.org.
Great, Anthony. And if you don't have a garden, you can do it from elsewhere, is that right?
Yeah, you can do it anywhere at all, even in a park or even in a car park or somewhere like that. I know some butterflies will turn up in planting in car parks and things like that. So really anywhere. We're hoping to get as many counts as possible. That's particularly important for Scotland because oftentimes we don't get many reports from certain parts of Scotland. So really getting the whole country involved will help us see how butterflies are doing throughout the whole of Scotland.
Lepidopterists are notoriously aggressive, and I don't want to start a fight, but do moths count?
Moths absolutely do count, yeah, and there are a couple of moths in the Big Butterfly Count this year, and there are some of the more distinctive day-flying moths, including the six-spot burnet and the silver Y, which tend to be quite common at this time of year, and they're really easy to identify, and the app or the website will show you how to identify those.
Just describe the six-spot burnet.
So it's a really beautiful moth. It's one of the ones which flies during the day, and it looks completely black with six red spots on each wing. But then if you look at it on a sunny day, you'll see that it's actually iridescent. So depending on the angle of the sun, sometimes it can look kind of black, blue, or even green or yellow, but just depending on the angle of the sun. So it's a really beautiful moth. And in flight, you can see the red undersides of the wings coming out. So it's a really nice one to see. Yeah. And interestingly, the reason why it's black and red is to warn predators that is poisonous, and that's how it gets away with flying during the day, that it can give a dose of hydrogen cyanide to any birds which try to attack it.
Well, that I didn't know.
Wow.
We've got horses, so you know we don't like ragwort as a plant, for example, because it's bad for horses. But I mean, basically, the burnet moth loves ragwort.
Well, there's a similar moth to the burnet moth called the cinnabar moth, which is also black and red, and again, it does use ragwort. And it takes the toxins from the wag root and then uses that to poison any would-be predators. And again, that's how they get away with flying during the daytime.
Love it. Saw piles of them this week, actually, up at Mugdock Country Park, not too far from my house. Anthony, why is it important to carry out counts like this?
It's extremely important because we really want to know what's happening to butterflies and people monitoring them in some of the best sites, such as nature reserves and wilder places. We really want to see how they're doing in some of our urban spots and some of the less recorded spaces. And we know that butterflies are declining. 3/4 of butterfly species in the UK have declined in the past 40 years. So updates like this are really important because then we get more information coming in. And it really shows us how the whole environment is doing, because butterflies respond very quickly to things like climate change and to land use changes. So we can see what impact those are having on UK biodiversity just by looking at the butterfly populations.
Should we be surprised at the decline in butterflies? Because basically all insects, I think it's fair to say, have been in decline.
Yeah, that's true. For the past at least 50 years or so, the agricultural market changed a lot, and that really has impacted butterflies and bees and many other insects, but then also the birds and the mammals which feed upon those as well. So they really are getting many strong impacts from different angles. And now we're also looking at the impacts of things like climate change. And interestingly, in Scotland, though, we are getting more species because of climate change, and new species are arriving every few years, coming up from the south and becoming resident in Scotland. And that seems to be a direct impact from climate change.
Mentioned Scotland there, Anthony, and you mentioned also that there's a few specific places you're interested in getting information from. Could you mention where those places are?
Yeah, so really anywhere. I mean, all counts are valid, but really some of the urban areas are some of the less recorded, so things like Glasgow and Edinburgh, but also up into the north, into Inverness, and even into parts of the Highlands and Islands. Some of these places we never get any records from for big butterfly count, so if people are listening from there today, we would definitely love for them to take part, especially. But we really love getting records from anywhere, because parts of Scotland can be vastly underrepresented in this data. We want to make sure that doesn't happen.
Anthony McCluskey there, Project Officer with Butterfly Conservation in Scotland. If you'd like to take part in that big butterfly count, there's a link to their website from ours. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Rody Crawford. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yes, you can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. But like hearing where you listen to the podcasts, email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is exactly what Lois Kirk did, and she writes,
"For some time now, I've been meaning to let you know how much your programme means in my life. Knowing how much I like listening to Scottish music and drama, our best man, a resident in Dornoch, told me about Out of Doors. Ian, my husband, and I met as students at Robert Gordon's Aberdeen. After graduating, Ian had to do a postgraduate course in London lasting a year. 53 years on, we have not returned to live in Scotland. Our hearts are still there, and we have enjoyed holidays north of the border over the years. 2 years ago, a nasty wee thief crept into my nervous system and robbed me of my sight overnight. With a great deal of support from friends, family and professionals, I've adapted to living life in new ways."
And Lois goes on to say, "Saturday mornings under the duvet, earbuds in, listening to you too is the highlight of my week. I really must get out more. Thanks very much for that. I'm with you every step of your journey as you describe everything you see in such wonderful detail. Your constant use of words not heard down south and your banter has me laughing out loud, usually waking Ian. Well, serves him right, should be up anyway. This means that we listen again later so you can enjoy it too. Very often I find out more about some of the topics you've dealt with, which grab my attention by using Siri and Google Assistant. As a drama teacher in a previous life, I love listening to the renditions of poetry and legends performed spectacularly." I wonder what she's listening to in your broadcasts. Moths, as we were just hearing there from Anthony, are fascinating creatures. Last year I made my own moth trap with fairly limited success, but to be honest, it pales into absolute insignificance compared to the structure I visited at the RSPB Loch Lomond Reserve this week in the company of visual artist Hannah Imlach.
So this is the Moth Quota. It's the largest sculpture I've ever made. It's a species and site responsive artwork. It's really designed as a sculpture to engage both humans and moths. It's a space that attracts moths through the night and then provides shelter for them in a collection of gathered night flowering aromatic plants. And it's designed as a space that humans can come to during the day and have an encounter with nocturnal creatures that we wouldn't otherwise come into contact with.
It is an extraordinary structure. It's a cross between the spire in Liverpool Cathedral. You know, there's a clear, probably plastic ball on the top, or a white plastic ball
blown
on the top.
Blown acrylic.
There's
only one person in the UK who makes spheres like this. His name is Charles, and he made the spheres on the original Daleks.
You're joking, did
he? He did.
Wow. Okay.
So it's quite an unusual process.
But each of these panels is open. It's almost like a sort of gauze effect. So once the moths are in there, they can't get back out.
Yes, the moths are attracted to this sphere. It's inside the sphere is mounted a UV bulb, so at night it glows a gentle blue. And moths are attracted always to the base of a light source. So they will fly underneath the sphere, down this galvanized cone, and then into the structure. And as you say, there's this hexagonal mesh on the side.
There's quite a few moths up there at the top at the moment.
Yes, if you come around here, there's a poplar hawk moth, one of the larger hawk moths. It's quite spectacular just on the top of this panel.
Yeah.
They're such a gift artistically, the colour, the form, the patterns, the relationships of each one with different plants. They're really incredibly diverse, and I find them very inspiring.
Can we go into this?
We can. Let me open.
Okay.
Let me open one of the panels. Right.
The entire triangular section of this structure comes off.
You can see some of the moths on the inside here.
That's beautiful. That's almost like lichen.
Yes. One. They are incredible mimics and shape-shifters. So in one of the books that I've been reading on moths, you see that there are some that mimic autumn leaves on the forest floor. There are some that mimic light travelling through branches. Some mimic as caterpillars. They mimic parts of trees, branches, lichens. So they not only do they go through several total transformations in their lives, they also take on these beautiful forms which mimic other parts of the natural world.
Let's step inside.
There's a nice white ermine here as well. Jared Spinkov is in the Marilyn Monroe of the moth world. Very glamorous.
This is just a lovely space because essentially it's you're inside but you're outside.
Yes.
You know, because it is just mesh, you know, there's air all about you. There's this, in front of us, growing area. Again, it's a lovely lattice work. So it's probably about, I don't know, about 5.5, 6 feet high. There's another moth there. But, I mean, there's honeysuckle. There's all sorts of things in it. It's over 6 feet high. Over 6 feet high.
So I know that when the side panels are totally unfolded, so it opens like a flower, each panel folds to the floor, it's 11 metres across, so it's quite tall. It's going to be difficult to get back in my studio, that's definitely something. But when I design sculptures, I gather inspiration from the natural world, but I also look at the tools and technologies that we use to discover, to explore, to learn more. So I was looking at early moth trap designs. There's a trap called the Rothamsted trap, which is quite commonly used, which uses this kind of pyramidal structure. But I wanted something that was perhaps less aggressive than the Rothamsted trap, which kills moths on entry. I wanted to create a space of encounter, of kind of inquisitiveness, something that wasn't going to cause any damage to the life that it was stretching out towards. And I'd done a residency prior to my PhD in Finland, and every night of the residency, we gathered as a group in the Kota, and
the moth. Good. That was my next question.
Name,
Why is it called a Kota?
Yes, so a Kota is it's the Finnish term for a traditional Sami structure, which is a place of shelter and gathering, a space where people gather around a fire, a bit like a Scottish bothy.
I see exactly what you mean. Though it's not. It is a trap, but it's not a trap. It is a place of encounter. It's somewhere where you can come face to face with, you know, something that you would walk past hundreds and hundreds of times in a wood and never have the faintest idea.
Yes.
And they're so delicate too.
Yes, this is what still excites me about this project, is that these beautiful organisms are all around us. I'm not drawing them from somewhere else and bringing them here. They all exist in this little piece of woodland, and this sculpture just makes them visible. But I've been really lucky. The reserve manager here, Paula, and I set up a working group around this artwork. So we invited in members of the RSPB who work particularly in public engagement and interpretation. We had moth experts, entomologists, local moth recorders, interested volunteers, members of the reserve team, people who work on kind of strategy. And we all came together and had monthly meetings about the direction of this artwork. And some of those conversations meant that I had to redesign elements. Some meant that I had to present the artwork to the chief ecologist of Scotland and make sure that what we were doing was ethical in terms of...
First, do no harm.
Yes, yeah, that's at the centre of it. And so there's push and pull within the RSPB, like any similar organisation, between engaging the public and preserving fragile ecologies. And this project is really at the edge between those two desires.
There's a beautiful echo here. So that, you know, as night falls, you know, as you get to twilight, all these various triangular panels will open out like a flower.
Like a moonflower.
Exactly. I mean, like these sort of night-scented plants that you have bang smack in the centre of it. So there's an echo there.
Yeah, so some of the key references are the sphere at the top. I read very early on that moths orientate themselves by their food plants, but also by the stars and the moon. So I was really fascinated by the sensory world of the moth, and I wanted to make the light source in my moth encounter artwork like a moon. I just didn't know if the moths were going to be attracted into the structure. So yesterday, when I, at about 6 in the morning, when I arrived for the first time, and I saw the first moth inside, my heart. Yes, it's been about a year in the planning. So the fact that there are moths in here, that it works, I'm so happy. I'm exhausted, but I'm so happy.
Anna Imlach there on our moth quota, and there is just time to squeeze in a guided visit to the quota. You'll find links to it on our webpage. I have to say, it's been a long time since I've seen anything that I thought was so clever, because it's completely harmless to the moths, but it allows you to experience a creature which is cryptic. I mean, you never find it in a month of Sundays during the day. Not a chance. But you can go and sit there quietly in amongst these night-scented flowers and actually see them. It's wonderful.
Brilliant. Great bit of interface between the artistic and the natural worlds. Yeah. Love it. I also love moth names as well. It's like Lepidopterus sat there all in the 70s going, hey man, I got a few names for you. How about like a rosy rustic, an elephant, a hawk moth, gold spangle, Hebrew prophet man?
Yeah,
I love it. But I think one of my favourites has actually got a much more mundane name. I used to do guided walks on Isla at Lochrinier RSPB Reserve. And in lieu or the risk of there being no birds around, I thought, I'm going to do a moth trap the night before, and then I've got some guaranteed things to show people. And I think moths need that profile. People need to know that moths are exciting. They're not just, you know, wee drab things. So I'd set up a moth trap, get it all done. And for the first month, right enough, it was in April on Isla, right? So the weather's not great for moth trapping. But for the first month of my guided walks, the only moth that appeared in my moth trap for me to show to people was called a clouded drab. And it was drab.
Pretty boring. Pretty boring. Yeah, to be honest, I think moth experts just look at them in a slightly different way. I don't know. We were talking about eels earlier. Sandy Main, who's pretty much of a regular on this show, has come up with an absolutely cracking story. He spent 4 lovely years working in farms in New Zealand in the 1970s at a time when the rivers were full of eels. Somebody saw the chance to make some money by selling live eels to Korea, and so an old Sayfair, Second World War freighter, it's a type of plane, was commissioned. To save weight, the eels were packed in a newly built area developed material known as polystyrene. Now, polystyrene boxes have come a long way in design and strength since then, but at the time they were a bit brittle, and so it proved. The plane had to make a refueling stop on a Pacific island, but it came down quite hard, which caused some of the boxes to break. The ice quickly melted, and the eels came out of their frozen state and went into the workings of the aircraft. The pilots, quite sensibly, said, "We're not flying that." More ice melted, there was general confusion, as now there was eels everywhere, wriggling to every part of the aircraft, where they up and died, basically. The aircraft never flew again, according to Sandy. People lost a lot of money. The environment suffered, and unfortunately Sandy hears that the rivers in New Zealand are polluted and no longer support the abundant wildlife they did half a lifetime ago. Fabulous story, Sandy. Thank you very much for that.
Remarkable. And if you wondered where the movie Snakes on a Plane came from,
that's it.
There you are.
It was Sandy Main. Sandy Main. We've been speaking about birds quite a bit this morning. To continue the theme, there's a big old bird in the news recently that caught Rory's attention.
Albatrosses, superlative-defying, ocean-traversing birds immortalised in poetry and myth, and also the birds I spend a lot of my working time trying to conserve, albeit in front of a computer screen. There are 22 species and 15 are threatened with extinction, with bycatch and fisheries the major threat to these birds at sea. Although familiar in as much as you might have studied the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner at school, most people will never see one. They're mostly found flying over the southern oceans, where the winds, affectionately known as the Roaring Forties and Screaming Fifties, are perfect at keeping these large-winged soaring birds in the air with minimal flapping required. They also tend to nest in far-flung places. Think Tristan da Cunha, South Georgia and South Sandwich Islands, and a host of other sub-Antarctics. But you might have seen that once again, a black-brown albatross has cropped up on the Yorkshire coast, spending a fair bit of time at RSPB's Bempton Cliffs Nature Reserve. There are suspicions that this is the same bird that first appeared at the Bass Rock, just days before Celtic lifted the European Cup in 1967. From the early 70s, it then spent 20-odd years at Hermanness in Shetland, before moving to Sulaskir in the mid-2000s, and after a stint in Heligoland, Germany, popped up in Yorkshire. If you know your seabird colonies, you'll maybe be aware of the common theme among all these places. They're all gannet colonies. If you're an albatross marooned in the North Atlantic, a gannet probably looks as close to your mates back home as you're going to get. A big white seabird that likes to nest in a colony. But the similarities end there. How does an albatross end up here? The answer might be storms. The low winds or doldrums of the tropics mean that birds like albatross that use dynamic soaring to fly can't punch through to the northern hemisphere. A sustained stormy period may have permitted this bird to pop through the tropics to the windier North Atlantic. Others postulate that this bird, affectionately known as Albert Ross, I know, eye roll, hitched a ride on a ship. It's not the first record, however. There was a black-brown albatross in the Faroes for 30 years in the late 1800s, and yet another popped up recently in the Bahamas. I know where I'd rather be. What does an albatross make of its life in the wrong hemisphere? I'm a scientist, but I can't resist an anthropomorphic journey into the mind of a lost albatross. Is it desperate to find colonial kinship with the gannets? What do the gannets make of this bird they don't normally encounter, even on their winter migrations to West Africa? Surely it's a lonely life. These are birds that mate for life. Or maybe it's happy to be exploring new terrain, breaking new albatross ground. Happy to be feeding on different delicacies than its southern siblings. We'll never know what's going on behind Albert's mascara dyes, but if the prospect of a trip to the Falkland Islands seems daunting, too expensive, or unlikely, well, why not pop down for a weekend on the Yorkshire coast and see what human emotions you can impose on a lost bird.
If it's an albatross in Yorkshire, do we have to call it Talbatross? Just wondering. Albert the albatross, as in Albert Tatlock the albatross.
It's entirely up to you. The bird doesn't have to be called Albert anyway, so no, call it whatever you fancy.
It doesn't care. When we were on our trip to Loch Tay in Benlores last month, Ewan was very keen to show me a place he knew of on the shores of the loch that's got a lot of folklore attached to it.
This is a strange and slightly witchy area. We came off the main road, the main drag, which goes to the north of Loch Tay. Parked the car up here, walked a long, long way down a steep, steep hill, and we've more or less come onto the loch shore and found ourselves surrounded by ruins. And by ruins, I mean, you know, it's basically the wall heads. Well, most of these wall heads are standing maybe 6 feet high. And there's trees going up through them. There's rowan. And there's ash, and there's gein, you know, wild cherry, dog rose and things. The stones that have been rubbled down are all covered in this shaggy, khaki-coloured lichen. But this is a big community. I mean, a huge house here, another one, two, three, possibly four down there. What was this?
This is the old village
of Lores. The new one is high on the hill next to the pub. But this in 1700 was the House of Lores. You know, the lady was married to a powerful laird, you know, they controlled everything. But to build a house this size, potentially three floors, in the 1700s, made, they were doing well. But she, I'm going to use the word notoriety, but that's probably the wrong word. She had a gift for seeing. And the first one started with a church. They were building a new church. And she said, the capping stones will never be laid on this church. And sure enough, shortly afterwards, the capping stones, the roofing bits, were being brought up by boat, and it sank. And they lost them all. And she had a thing about this church, because she planted an ash tree and said, when it reaches the gable, the church will split. And shortly after that, when it did reach the gable, the roof fell in. But a couple of years later was the Great Disruption.
The schism.
Yeah.
So that could have been the split as well.
Yeah, when the congregation upped, left the church and joined the Free Kirk.
Okay.
I mean, that's a real split.
Yeah.
There was another couple of predictions relating to Drumochter. We said, carriages of fire will pass through the glen.
It's a train by any other means.
It's got to be a train. This was long before it. And that ships powered by smoke will power up the loch.
Mm-hmm.
And that one would be lost with great life. Well, there was one sank, but I don't think anybody lost their lives on it.
Mm-hmm.
But she had a thing about the clearances. She said, the land will be ridded of its people. First they'll be sifted, and then no one will be close enough in these glens to hear its neighbour's cock crow. And that's lovely wording.
But the poetic.
The population went from 3,500 down to 500.
Yeah.
You know, it's
and your neighbour wouldn't have been close enough, no. You know, if they kept hens or whatever, to hear the cockerel in the morning.
Yeah. And she did it here.
Yeah. I said, it is a strange, strange location. You know, it's a sunny day. Admittedly, we're standing underneath another ash tree. So it's slightly in shadow. The sky to the south is quite dark. Looks a bit thundery. But there is a slightly, I don't know, maybe it's just the fact it's ruins. Not all ruins feel ominous, but these do for some reason.
Yeah. It's, I don't know, you get that feeling of we're alone here.
Yeah.
I know we are, but...
And again, we've discussed this in the past, that, you know, neither of us has got any psychic sensitivity at all. We never feel anything. But if you are to accept the fact that some folk can somehow pick up, I don't know, like an echo, an image of the past, why can't you do it for the future? So maybe that's what her prophecy was. Maybe she was actually seeing these things. I don't know.
But how would you know in 1700 about the clearances coming?
How would you know about steam trains?
And railway carriages.
Yeah. Just after we visited, we noticed the fact that the old village of Lores is actually up for sale. It's yours for just at a snip at 125 grand, complete with the Lady of Lores or not. And our thanks to fiddler Pete Clark there for providing the music. You can hear more from him and many others on our first programme on the River Tay, available on the Scotland Outdoors podcast.
A few more emails coming in here, Mark. We've had somebody in sunny Perth, Hazel Rogers. Regular listener to the show. These past weeks I've been reading The Nature Fix by Florence Williams. Lots of science, but also lots of stories about how encountering nature is healing for the mind and soul.
Alistair McEachin says, came on an excellent display of the six-spot burnet moth on the tidal Macquar Island of Sunamul off the north end of Bombecula last week. Very colourful in the bright sunshine, and they would be.
And got another email here from Leslie from Edinburgh. I remember saying to a colleague who just returned from Australia how amazing I'd found the differences in birdsong and ambient noise there. He looked at me as though I was mad and said he hadn't noticed. I found that incredible and also felt sad at what he was missing. Soundscape variety is a huge part of travel for me, loving the show as ever.
Yeah, me too.
Again, it depends what you're tuned into. Text here from Donald Thompson saying, thanks for another great show. Picked up on checking on rats. I'm assuming the chance. I'm heading out there by sea kayak as part of a Minch crossing next weekend. Been wanting to go back for a while. Should be much more enjoyable now the rats are eradicated.
It was the precursor to that project, so well spotted.
Well spotted, that man.
Yeah.
It does make a huge difference if you get rid of the rats, though.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just seabirds are not designed to cope with them, so getting rid of them makes a huge difference.
Yeah, although it's a very time-consuming process and it only takes one rat to get back in there.
Absolutely. It's one thing to do the project and get rid of them. The next thing is really the biosecurity and making sure they keep off. That's critical.
Yeah, remember some of that in St Kilda. You know, basically, you cannot land on St Kilda. Well, occasionally they bring in a landing craft, but it's unusual. And even then, there's a ring of people round about it just to check nothing comes off it. Sadly, that is it for us this week. Look out for our midweek podcast, which features a lovely guy called Rory McPhee of the Lynder Curative Forest in Fife, a place dedicated to making people feel better by connecting with the trees. From Rory and me, thanks for listening.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.